really good.
We had talked about chapter 38. Now, as a little background, you remember that Job had desired an audience with God. He didn't understand his afflictions, and he almost accused God of unfairness. He was disappointed. He was displeased, but he never sinned in attacking God's character. We read that at the very first. His position was wondering why, and we consistently wonder why these things are happening. I cannot imagine why someone like David Gray, who is a successful missionary in Albania, would have to come home because he has cancer. See, we just do not understand what God is doing. So we don't try. We praise Him and thank Him and pray for every need that we know about. But Job is really, really wondering. So in verse 38, the Lord appears to Job, and we've already done it, so we're just going to talk about it in a minute and then go on to chapter 39. But the Lord appears to Job out of a whirlwind and asks him many, many, many questions. In this translation, I counted 38 question marks in 41 verses. And he is really giving Job the once-over about what he does not know, and accuses him of darkening counsel by words without knowledge. In other words, talking about things he really doesn't know anything about. And he said, I'm going to ask you some questions, and you're going to answer me. So he asked him all of these questions about the elements. He talks to him about the winds. He talks to him about the light and the darkness. He talks to him about the weather, the snow, the hail, the irregularity of weather patterns. He talks to him about all of the waters, the bodies of water. And Job, he's just totally ignorant, verses 28 through 30, prove that Job is ignorant of all of these things. And God is questioning him and teaching him. But remember, God is not condemning him. He is enlightening him. He is teaching him. But there's no condemnation in the remarks and the questions that God makes to Job, because God is not a God who condemns. He convicts, but he doesn't condemn. And that's good news. Even in the New Testament, we know there's no condemnation to those that are in Christ Jesus. Job's ignorance is extended throughout all the things that God begins to talk to him about. In verse 37, he mentions wisdom. And going on, we went through it, so we won't go through it again. And beginning in verse 39 of chapter 38, God begins to talk to Job about some animals. He talks to him about the lion in verse 39. And he talks to him about the raven in verse 41. And then he continues in the next chapter to talk to him about animal life. There are six beasts, and this is just a kind of a little review, and four birds that he talks to him about. And these birds and these beasts include the fierce, the helpless, the shy, the strong, the totally bizarre, and the wild. And that's just a kind of a resume about all kind of beasts that there are. Now, only the lion and the raven are mentioned in chapter 38, and the rest of them, and the three birds, other birds, are mentioned in chapter 39. Now, looking at chapter 39, we find, let me read chapter 38 to you out of this little, it's Eugene Peterson's book, it paraphrases it. I know it's not real scholarly, and, you know, I wouldn't want to use it as a text to teach by, but it almost gets to be comical. And he never gets away, really, from what God is asking Job. Let me read to you real quickly. He says, have you gotten to the bottom of things? And finally God answered Job from the eye of the storm and said, why do you confuse the issue? Why do you talk without knowing what you're talking about? Pull yourself together, Job. Up on your feet now. Stand tall. I have some questions for you, and I want some straight answers. And that's exactly what the New King James says, except this is just in a more ordinary language. He said, where were you when I created the earth? Tell me, since you know so much. Who decided on its size? Certainly you'll know that. Who came up with the blueprints and the measurements? You remember we talked about the foundation? Mm-hmm. How was its foundation poured, and who set the cornerstone? While the morning stars sang in chorus and all the angels shouted praise. Who took the charge of the ocean, and when it gushed out forth like a baby from a womb? That was me. I wrapped it in soft clouds and tucked it safely at night. Then I made a playpen for it, a strong playpen so it couldn't run loose. And I said, stay here now. This is your place. Your wild tantrums are confined to this place. He's talking about the ocean and the wild, violent waves. If you've ever been to a beach, you see them. But don't worry, they're not going to get out of control. That is as true today as it was when God spoke this to Job. The tides are regulated. In Jeremiah, the prophet said, it says, thus far and no farther. And if that ever got out of control, you see, the whole earth would be inundated with water. But God is in control. Have you ever ordered morning and said, get up? And he said, have you ever had any effect on the daybreak? Have you ever told the dawn, get to work? So you could seize earth like a blanket and shake out the wicked like cockroaches. As the sun brings everything to light, brings out all colors and shapes. The cover of darkness is snatched from the wicked. They're caught in the very act. Have you ever gotten to the true bottom of things and explored the labyrinth caves of the deep ocean? Do you know the first thing about death? Do you have one clue regarding death's mysteries? And do you have any idea how large the earth is? Speak up if you have even a beginning of an answer. Do you know where the light comes from and where darkness lives so that you can take them by the hand and lead them home if they get lost? Why, of course you know that. You've known that all your life. You've grown up in the same neighborhood with them. That was true. Have you ever traveled to where the snow is made? Have you ever seen the vault where hail is stockpiled? The arsenals of hail and snow that I keep in readiness for times of trouble and battle and war. Can you find your way to where lightning is launched or to the place from which the wind blows? Who do you suppose carves canyons from the downpours of rains and charts and the routes of thunderstorms that bring water to unvisited fields to deserts where no one ever lays eyes on? Drenching useless wastelands so that they're carpeted with wildflowers and grass. Who do you think is the father of the rain and the dew and the mother of ice and frost? You don't for a minute imagine that these marvels of weather just happen, do you? Can you catch the eye of the beautiful Pleiades sisters or distract Orion from the hunt? Can you get Venus to look your way? You need someone? That's all right. We haven't really gotten into it yet. Can you get Venus to look your way or get the great bear and her cubs to come out and play? Do you know the first thing about the sky's constellation or how they affect things on earth? You see, all of this is a part of creation, and it was all finished in 6 days. Isn't that amazing? The only two things that have ever been finished are creation and salvation. I brought Rhonda, the little girl was in here a minute ago, a couple of daylilies that I just went out and grabbed this morning. And it's the most fascinating thing. Now, God made the first one. He made the first daylily. And ever since that time, men have taken the pollen from one and placed it on the pistil, P-I-S-T-I-L, of another, and then let that plant go to seed. And the next year they'll plant that seed in the hope of getting something different, but it's still a daylily. Nothing has ever been created. Some of you haven't heard this interesting story, and I think it's worth telling. My sister was in college at the university, and she met this professor, and somehow or other it was discovered that I was a daylily fiend. So this professor said, well, I have a lot of azaleas in my yard that I will give to your sister. He said, I've hybridized them. That's cross-pollination to get a new variety. I hybridized them. And if they're not different enough to give a new name, he said, I just give them away. I plant them and look at them. He said, tell your sister that she can come and get them. So I made arrangements to go out there. And you'd never guess if you didn't already know who that professor was. It was Ned Davis's father. Isn't that amazing? And I had never seen him because he was away in the war. So I guess I must have hauled several hundred daylilies from out there. And some of them, I would imagine, are still at Baker Heights School because I put them around and gave them away. They were beautiful. But he had hybridized them, but nobody's ever created anything new. They'll talk about cloning and crossbreeding, but everything that was made was finished in those 6 days. Isn't that amazing? Our God is awesome, isn't he? And you look at the colors and flowers, just those few sweet peas over there in that vase, the different colors and shades of coloring, you realize that God has really, really created the most everything beautiful, everything useful. Man, from the very first creation, has everything that he really needed was created because he began to live with the substance and the things that God had created. And then life has steadily progressed. Can you get the attention of the clouds? Can you commission a shower of rain? Can you take charge of the lightning bolts and have them report to you for orders? Remember we talked about that? Who do you think gave weather wisdom to the ibis and snow savvy to the rooster? Storm savvy to the rooster. How many of you know that hens and roosters know when there's a storm coming? They really do. They got more sense than we have. Does anyone know enough to number all the clouds or tip over the rain barrels of heaven? When the earth is cracked and dry and the ground baked hard as a brick, does anyone have power to turn over the rain barrels? No, they don't. Can you teach the lioness to stalk her prey and satisfy the appetite of her cubs as they crouch in their dens, waiting hungrily in their caves? And who set out food for the ravens when their young cry to God, fluttering about because they have no food? And what God is saying, I have this all in control, Job. Have you ever wondered about how really awesome I really am? But not in condemnation. He's doing it as a matter of illumination and sharing with Job this great power that he really has. Now, Job knew him, but he's going to know him. He said, I thought I knew you. I knew you, but I really know you after he gets through talking to him. And so in scanning verse 39, we find six wild mountain goats. We find six animals, wild mountain goats, deer, wild donkey, wild ox, a horse, and then we find three kinds of birds, raven, an ostrich, and the stork. Now, these animals and birds have very unusual habits, we're going to see. They pounce on their prey. They soar in the sky. They run at high speeds. They live in deserts. They fight fearfully, living also in mountains, build nests on mountain crags, a great variety of behavior. And God asked Job a bunch of questions about all of these strange things, of these strange habits of these animals. And God is telling Job that his care is more than just for man. The whole creation is bigger than you and your problems, Job. You know, sometimes we feel that just the opposite of that. God provides food, sets the pattern for birthing their young, and describes their extraordinary ways. And these verses are really, really fascinating. And if you haven't read through them, we'll read through them very, very quickly, very fast. He said, do you know the time when the wild mountain goats bear? Can you mark when the deer gives birth? I'm reading, just scanning. The number of months they fulfill? Or do you know the time when they bear young? They bow down, they bring forth their young, deliver their offspring, and their young ones are healthy, tall with grain, they grow strong with grain, depart and do not return to them. And see, the young ones go out from them, and they never even see and hear from them again. Who set the wild donkey free? Who loosed the bonds of the Onager, whose home I have made in the wilderness? And that's a strange name of an animal far, strange to us. And he goes on through verse 8, talking about the habits. I don't want to take time to really read all the verses. Looking then at verse 5 through 9, he talks about the donkey. I'll just scan those. Then verse 9, he begins to talk about the wild ox and his habit. Can you bind him with ropes? Will you trust him because his strength is great? And he asks Job all about these questions, about all of these creatures. And what he has proven to Job is that Job really doesn't know much about God's omnipotent power, the awesomeness. Do you ever think about it? I mean, just imagine all the animal life, wild and domesticated. Those things that we never track down. We go to the zoo and see them. We go to the circus and watch them perform. Then we go to the market and buy that other kind that's domesticated that God has made for our food. I mean, the awesomeness of His creative power. And I've talked about this so much that you're tired of hearing it, but the vegetables and fruits that God has made for our pleasure. You see, there's just no way that you can describe the awesomeness of this power. And this is what God is getting over to Job. Job, he talked a lot. He knew a lot. He never really blamed God. But he is telling him, Job, you really don't know much. You really need to find out who I am. And he does tell him who he is. In looking at beginning in verse 13, you find a description of the ostrich. This is the dumbest of all wild creatures. He lacks any wisdom. It's said to weigh about 300 pounds and can run. I mean, those things can run fast. And when their feet hit the ground, it sounds like rolling thunder. It's fascinating to watch them. The Lord blessed me, and it was just a blessing of His, to go to Africa 1 year with a group. And they arranged for a safari. I had wanted to do that all my life. And honestly, to see an ostrich take off and run. Have any of you ever seen one? Isn't that something, Patty? Anybody else? When they take off and run, it sounds like thunder is clapping down through the field. And they're just stupid. He goes on to talk about how stupid they are. Beginning in verse 13. She leaves her eggs on the ground. Just drops eggs. And other animals will come along and destroy them. But enough of them are hatched that the species continues. Warms them in the dust. Instead of sitting on them to warm them, they warm in the dust. She forgets that a foot may crush them or that a wild beast may break them. Now, that's the height of stupidity. A female animal that will lay a batch of eggs and not have sense enough to take care of them. Don't even think about something coming along to destroy them. But God takes care of it. See, this is the bottom line. God knows her stupidity. Take care of it. She doesn't even take care of her young, verse 16. Her labor is in vain without concern. She doesn't realize the emotional side of motherhood. I'll tell you what, a hen does. You put your hand in a nest where, and you'll get to hurt. This is true. Any mother creature protects their young. A cat with kittens, a dog with puppies. I mean, there is a maternal, but not this stupid creature. And what God is saying, that from all areas of creation, Job, you thought you knew something, but you just take another look at the whole thing, is what he's saying. You just consider. She treats her young harshly as though they were not even hers. Verse 8, 16. 17. Because God, now listen to this, God deprived her of wisdom. Did you hear that? it was God's plan that the ostrich not have any wisdom and did not endow her with any understanding. When she lifts herself on high, she scorns the horse and the rider. I'll tell you, she can outrun any horse. She can she just leaves them in the dust when she gets ready to run. I've seen that. And it's just fascinating to see. And they even look stupid. They don't look like they have a grain of sense about anything. But they're dotted all over that grassland in Africa. And I don't know where else. I'm assuming probably some in Australia. But God is in charge of all of this glorious creation. And he's putting Job in his place. But not with condemnation, but with enlightenment and instruction. So what the whole purpose of Job, and this is why I say that every church that calls itself Christian should be somehow, I want to say encouraged, but that's not strong enough, should be forced to study the book of Job. Because, listen, the only way that God can take us to higher levels of knowledge and understanding and fellowship and relationship to him, the only way we can get there is to go through the valley route. The church in prosperity grows very little. The church in adversity grows much stronger. I'm really excited about the paper that I have for you on afflictions, and when we finish the chapters, we'll take a couple of Tuesdays to go through that. Galen Sawyer was teaching that and had a printout, shared the copy, and it's just tremendous. And it's scriptural. See, the verses, chapters, and everything are there on why afflictions add to our character. He said, well, I don't want my character added to that way. What you're saying is then I do not want to grow in my understanding of God. Because if you belong to him, now this sounds cruel, but I believe this. Maybe Tom will agree with me. If you belong to him, he is going to let happen to you what needs to happen to you in order to reveal himself to you. And the loudest thing I could say is that he is under no obligation whatsoever to explain anything to you or to me or to anyone. Our God is sovereign. The end of the drama was accomplished before the drama of salvation and redemption ever began. And you just think about this. And there's not a whole lot of desire to know this, but we still need to know that whom God loves, he chastens. So don't forget that. When you think you're at the whipping post, it's because God loves you. You probably have told your children, I'm punishing you because I love you. Have you ever told a child that? You are correcting you're shaping their character because you love them. And this is exactly, Job is passing from one level to another of his relationship to the Lord, and so many blessings that he receives back. Have you given the horse strength? And that's enough about the ostrich. He begins then to talking about the horse. He said enough about the ostrich. You don't need to say anything else. He's stupid as you can get. It's a good thing they're not prolific as cats and dogs and calves and cows, isn't it? So in verse 19 and 20, he talks about the horse. Did you make him strong? Did you clothe his neck with thunder? Can you frighten him like a locust? Can you handle all of that? How about this, Job? Have you ever had any part in this? See, Job has been made to realize the genius of the creation. You ever stop and think? I hate to keep saying that. But the little critters and the big ones and the middle-sized ones each have a place and a purpose. I heard a funny thing down in, I think it's kind of funny, and I'll tell it now. It doesn't really fit, but I'll tell it anyway. Somebody asked, said, do you know who paid the bills on the ark? Of course, I didn't know. I said, well, the lizard had the greenback, and the frog had the greenback, and the duck had the bill, and the skunk had the scent, so put them all together. this is another amazing thing, that everything that God created was preserved on the ark. Am I right? Huh? All but the fish, they were still there. They didn't have to get on board. But you know, just to think about the wonders, the creative wonders that brought everything into existence, and God has shown His wisdom and His power and His genius, and all. He should have, but He didn't. We still have them, and we pay people, you know, once every month or two to get rid of them for us. But somehow or another, there is a purpose. The entire chapter, though, about all of this animal life, it's just really fascinating. God asked Job all of these questions about these six beasts and these four birds. What a variety. Just think about the variety of the size and the habits of these. Only the genius, you see, of God could do it and keep it happening. We still have all these things. Now, we don't have ostriches everywhere. And in the next chapter, it talks about the hippopotamus. We don't have them everywhere. But he did create them, and they're still in existence. The giraffe isn't mentioned, but I think he's one of the most fascinating. You know, that old neck is so tall, and he just eats his lunch out of the top of a tree. It's just fascinating. By a committee. That's good. A giraffe, Tom said, a giraffe is a horse put together by a committee. Got any other thing you want to add to that? He is mentioned here, but I don't know why he didn't talk about him, but he couldn't talk about every animal that he had created. God's questions, see, and it's interesting now to notice that his questions begin with the king of what we call the king of beasts, who is the lion, and ends with the king of birds, which is the eagle. Down in, he talks about the hawk in verse 26, and then in verse 27 he talks about the eagle. Does the eagle mount up at your command? Can you tell the eagle what to do, Job? And make it and get up and make its nest on high, on the rock where it dwells and lives, on the crag of the rock and the stronghold? From there it spies out its prey. I tell you, the eagle is a smart critter. From the top of a tree, he'll spy a long ways out and find something that he intends to get and eat, and takes off and flies fast and majestically, and can fly fast in the face of a storm. You know, we are compared to eagles. And the prophet Isaiah, that way we want, the Lord shall mount up with wings as eagles. I want to tell you, when an eagle spies something it wants, it'll get it. Can you see any connection between the kind of Christianity that we ought to have? Mount up with wings as eagles. And not faint and not get weary, because an eagle never quits until it gets what it's going after. Brother Ern Baxter has a tremendous tape on life on wings, and he talks about when that eagle gets ready to get that baby out of that nest, that she just kicks him out. There's no mercy, there's no tenderness, there's no mama love demonstrated. She just kicks him out, and it's time for him to go. But that's part of her habit. And we just have to marvel at what God is doing. In the last verse, the last of the verses, it observes from afar the eagle. Its young ones suck up blood. Where the slain are, there it is. That eagle will kill something, and the babies will go there. It's interesting in the grassland how that animals, big animals, will kill smaller animals, and then their young ones will go and eat that animal. And it's amazing how it keeps going. But life is always preserved. And until the very end, all of these things will be a part of God's great creation. Did you ever go to a really good zoo? Mm-hmm. Nearly everybody's gone. And just look at what God has made. It's just from the ridiculous to the sublime. Every child should go to a good zoo and then just look at God's creation and listen to an explanation of a guide about what God has done. In chapter 40, the Lord answered Job and said, "And what amount are you going to keep on? You're gonna contend with him and try to. Some Bibles call the contender is it some in some Bibles it's the contender. This one is the one who contends, and another translation is called the fault finder. With a fault finder, continue with the Almighty to correct the Almighty. If you can rebuke God, then you can answer this. So he really addresses him. And for the first time, for the very first time, Job is in a position to answer the Lord. And he said, I am vile. Well, he is really beginning to learn something. He is realizing his helplessness. That he really, in comparison to the awesome power of God to produce and provide and to keep things going, that Job, really, he is nothing. Well, I want to have some news for you. He was nothing and you and I are nothing. Back in, he said, I am vile. What shall I say to you? I want to share with you Genesis chapter 18, verse 27, just to show you that the great people of the Bible, some of them realized that they truly were nothing. I hope I have it right. Yes. Genesis chapter 18, and it's verse 17. I'll get it right in a minute. It's chapter 18, verse 27. I have it right now. Chapter 18, verse 27. Then Abraham answered and said, Indeed now I am but dust and ashes, and have taken it upon myself to speak to the Lord. You see, there's the same reaction from Abraham as from Job. I am vile. I have spoken. I have taken too much on myself. In Isaiah chapter 6 and verse 5, you're probably familiar with that. Isaiah chapter 6, verse 5, Isaiah says, Woe is me. I am undone because I am a man of unclean lips. And he goes on to talk there. And in chapter 5 of Luke's gospel, if you look there or listen, Luke chapter 5 and verse 8, when Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees and said, Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord. And the reason to stress this is to see that when God makes himself known, then man realizes, even Abraham, Isaiah, and Peter, three great characters in the Bible, they realize in God's presence, they are nothing. And we are the same. And yet, put the shoe on the other foot, we're family. We're children of God. But not by anything which we've done, but by his awesome power of recreation, creating in us a new creature. I mean, it just does us good to sometimes just think about the ways of God, doesn't it? It helps me. Just think about the grace of God by which he enables us to go from day to day. We're saved by this grace. We're kept by this grace. I mean, it's just the solemn facts are worth really rejoicing about, aren't they? But you know, the rejoicing about this is the most awesome thing and would tend to me to quieten us more than make us noisy. I mean, to really, you understand what I'm saying? I mean, just to bow in the presence of a God that has made all things fit together like he has. And that came himself in flesh, in the person of his son, to shed his blood for our sins. It's more than we can take in, really. It's just too much to us to receive, but yet it's true. And we have this wonderful position of being in the family of God. As John says, what manner of love God has bestowed upon us that we should be the children of God. He said, and we are. But think about all the things that he has spoken to Job. We get back to Job, get sidetracked, but it all fits together. He said, I've spoken, but I will not answer. He said, what shall I say to you? I'll lay my hand over my mouth. And you know, that's just so down to earth. Sometimes when you're sitting there, think about that being a biblical thing. I lay my hand over my mouth. Once I've spoken, but I will not answer. Yes, twice, but I won't say anything yet. I've said, realizing that he's said enough. Now, he is continues there. God challenges Job, and he said, and again in the whirlwind, now act like a man. Prepare yourself like a man. I'm going to ask you some questions. He starts all over asking him questions again. And verse 8, he asked him, he said, would you declare me wrong? Would you annul my judgment? Would you condemn me that you may be justified? You know, just one of us right here now, Job. If you condemn me to justify yourself, and you're going to declare that my judgment is not right and yours is? Pretty awesome questioning, isn't it? Would you declare me wrong and condemn me so you could be justified in what you think? And then in verse 9, he talks about his arms. He's got an arm like mine. I'm going to tell you something, friends. The arm of God can embrace the universe. His hand reaches the uttermost. Can you do that, Joel? Can you thunder with a voice like his? And this next verse is so beautiful, fits so beautifully. What do you think? If so, then if you want to, if you can claim this to your knowledge and your position. Then he uses four words that are absolutely without comparison to describe the glory of God. Majesty, splendor, glory, and beauty. I think those four words just about describe the character of God. In his majesty, he rules. In his splendor, he is outstanding. In his glory, he manifests himself. That's what the glory of God is, a manifestation of his presence. And beauty, something beautiful. God is the most beautiful. You know, we just shut up. We can't say any more. But he says, now, Job, if you're going to try to annul my judgment, if you're going to take over, Job, if you're going to be able to explain everything, then you've got to have an arm as strong as mine. And you've got to have a voice like thunder, like mine. And you've got to array yourself in glory and splendor and majesty and beauty. I tell you, our God is never at a loss, is he? He so perfectly rebukes Job for what Job thought that he knew. The arm is the strength. The thunder is his voice and his character. Those four words there to describe the person of God. Then in verse 11, do what I do, he said. Disperse, that is to make it, shed it abroad, scatter it out, the rage of your wrath, and look on everyone who's proud. If you can handle everything, Job, I'll just turn you loose on all those folks full of pride. That's what it says. Disperse, that is scatter it out, the rage of your wrath, and look on everyone who's proud. And after you've looked on him, Job, well, humble him. You know, God has a way of doing that, doesn't he? Humility, this is my opinion, but humility is the most desired fruit of the Spirit because it recognizes who God is and who we are. Meekness and humility, that we are next to him, we're nothing. And in him, we're family. But this was not the subject of Job's discussion. This was his mighty, mighty power. Look on everyone who's proud and bring him low. Now, please, you can do all this, Job. You can handle the moral problems, too. If you can understand the physical problem, if you're strong as I am, then you can also take care of these sinners and all these people that are so proud and tread down the wicked. If you understand so much, Job, get to deal with sin. Now, he is really getting him straight. He is telling him what he really needs to know. Hide them in the dust together. Kill them. Bury them. Find their faces in hidden darkness. Get rid of them. If you've got so much power, if you understand all this. And then he said, I'll also confess to you that your own right hand can save you. If you can handle all these others, then you can save yourself. And then starting in verse 15 and going through verse 34 of chapter 41, almost two whole chapters, the Lord deals with and describes two largest animals of the world to demonstrate and describe his wisdom and his genius and Job's ignorance of creation and his helplessness. And he starts there in verse 15. I've got so many marks here. Verse 15, look at the behemoth. And most books that I looked at and commentaries say that's the hippopotamus. Somebody would even say the hippopotamus. Yes. And I've got, just lots of, probably the best books I have are on Job. I have so many good ones. You can't read them all. But most of the ones I take out, they'll say that most think it's the hippopotamus and or an animal whose identity cannot be named. But the hippopotamus certainly fits in here real nicely. Another translation, and I've forgotten where it is called The Beast Beyond Comparison, this behemoth. And then he starts there in verse 15, and everything, like I said, centers around these two animals. Job, the Lord asked Job a lot of questions, and these questions, which Job can't answer, are to prove to Job that God's wisdom and power are more than Job had ever even dreamed about. He knew him, he feared him, and yet, as we'll find out at the end, he didn't really know him. And this is the purpose to me and the thrill of Bible study together and meditation and just contemplating on God's ways, is that we know him, but we'll never know all we can know. See, their little books in the New Testament, I think that about the first epistle of John, just those five chapters, and that we could never fathom the depths of what John is saying about God, love, salvation, sonship, eternity. I've heard this, and I hate to say it, but there's so much ignorance about the character of God and biblical knowledge. We know so little about the little we know because God is so big, but there's an indifference to the importance of knowledge of God that has invaded this land, and I guess it invaded other lands. One of the preachers in Mexico told me 5 or 6 years ago, he said, Sister, the people here don't love the word like they used to. And it's sad, isn't it? And I'm just sure that must be a general kind of thing. But the more we learn about the awesome majesty and power of this God, the deeper we're going to bow ourselves, realizing that we stand in need of instruction, illumination, so that we can more perfectly
come to obedience. Oh, this is an awesome thing. The presence of God that created every tree, every grain of sand, every leaf that grows, everything that breathes. Animal, plant, everything. And has fitted into its own purpose, provided for its sustenance and its nutrition. And everything has some kind of purpose. See, I think Christians need to be reminded of the awesomeness of this God that we love and serve. God is saying, if you can do all this, then just prove that you're able to contend with me and get rid of all this wickedness. But what the Lord is doing is informing Job of his ignorance of his ways, not in condemnation. Now, sometimes they'll be a little cynical, you know, a little cynical there. If you can do that, Job, then you can do this. But not in condemnation. Let me tell you something. If God were influenced by anything that you and I thought up or wished or wanted, if he were influenced in the pattern of his doings, there'd be no order in this universe. Because everybody's got some input. Everybody could tell God how to do it. And there'd be no order if God paid any attention to anything that we would do instead of or to change or add to what he has done and is doing. Almost two whole chapters now, he talks about these two animals. We won't get into this to very much of it today. But these two critters are something. Between verses 15 of chapter 40 and the 34th verse of chapter 40, everything centers about these two animals, and it's fascinating. Let me go back and make a little summary statement. In chapter 38, verse 1 through 38, he asked Job, can you explain my creation? It's all about creation. And then beginning in chapter verse 39, going through 39 and 30, can you oversee and manage the creation, Job? Can you explain it? Can you control it? Can you manage it? And then the rest of it through 41-34 is, can you subdue it? Can you quiet it? Can you stop it? Some searching questions. Can you explain what I've done? Could you oversee it or change it? Or could you subdue any of these violent critters? Got any power, Job? Let me tell him, said, now just get up, stand up like a man. Just get ready for some questions, because I'm going to answer them, and I'm going to ask them, and you're going to answer them. But he knew Job wasn't going to answer them. But he's going to show Job his total, total inability to come to any understanding of what he's doing. In these verses, chapter beginning in verse 40, or if I just take a couple of minutes, starting in verse, he talks about this hippopotamus. And what is so fascinating here is his description. Just look at his, he said, I made, and this is cute, be sure you get this here. Look at the hippopotamus, the behemoth. He said, which I made along with you. The same power that created you, Job, created this big animal. Yeah, probably so. Did I share with you what I heard Mark Rutland say about foreign missions? Did I share that with this group? No? It doesn't fit here, but when she said mud, it does fit. He was at this same missionary, the same church that I was in this Sunday night. And this man got up and he said, you know, I do not like to hear people talk about foreign missions. Did I share that with you? World missions. We're not foreigners. We're all made out of the same mud. We have different cultures. We have different habits. We have different life patterns. But we're all, so don't say foreign. We're not foreigners. We're all is world. Because I guess whatever he made him out of, But he said, I love this. Along with you, Job, I created this big guy. And then he talks about how, we'll just look at a couple of these verses. He eats grass. His strength is in his hips. You ever seen a hippopotamus? They are the ugliest thing you can ever imagine. And all of their strength does seem to be in their hips. His power is in his stomach muscles. He moves his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are tightly knit. His bones are like beams of bronze, and his ribs like bars of iron. Boy, that's strong now. He is the first of the ways of God, and that is to say that he is the first in rank in size. He cannot be overshadowed by anything else that God has made. He is big, and he is strong, and he is different. He eats grass. You'd think he'd be eating other animals, wouldn't you? And then he talks about verse 19. Look at that again. He is the first in the ways of God, the most awesome thing God has made. Only he who made him can bring him near his sword. You don't kill one of these fellows very easily. Only God has the power to attack him and kill him. I read somewhere that an adult hippopotamus could weigh as much as 8,000 pounds. That's 2 tons. And in that area in Africa, in that grassland, you'll see them one out in the river. And that thing is so big that he'll take up half the width of that river. I mean, you're huge. And it's later on in here, he'll get down to the waters right up to his eyes. Get right up to his nose, but it doesn't drown. A really weird thing to bring to Job's attention, but big and strong and different. And he said, I made him just like I made you. Talks about the mountains yield food for him, and the fields of the and the beasts of the fields play there where he is eating. And he eats grass, so he doesn't bother those animals. The animals just play on the mountain while he eats the grass. Big, strong thing. Yes, and there are signs in that safari land that you don't go near. You stay in the van when you drive around where the rhinoceros. Because, you see, these animals are wild. There's no taming these critters. They're just there. That's their habitat. And the government makes tons of money by allowing tourists to see it, and it's fascinating. And it's also very dangerous, but there are signs posted. Do not leave your vehicle in that and certain other areas. But that is the most, I'm glad you brought that up, the most dangerous of all of these animals. He lies under the lotus trees and a covert of reeds and marsh. He just, you know, he's got a very comfortable place there. When he comes out of the water, he just lies down there. And the willow by the banks surround him. He's perfectly at home there. The river may rage, but he's not disturbed. It says, he is confident, though the Jordan gushes in his mouth. And that Jordan there was a Hebrew translation for a fast stream or a great stream of water, swift running current. It can reach to his eyes and it can reach to his nose. And he's not disturbed no matter how fast the water is flowing. He's really giving him a tremendous description. He is confident, though he takes it in his eyes, the water, or one pierces his nose with a snare. He is indestructible. He is not harmed if one even hits him, or if the water even hits him, or someone pierces his nose with a snare. He just takes it on. But yet, you see, we know they've been conquered because we've seen them in zoos. But there wasn't any zoo on earth at the time that that God addressed this to Job. I mean, this was something, and I don't know how they catch him, but in those times, he was a creature, and God intended it to be, that could not easily be handled. But God can handle him. Only God can handle him. And certainly Job cannot. Well, I don't, you see, let me say this before we quit. Job had misjudged God on the way things appeared. Let that get in your brain. You ever misjudged God just on the way things seem to be? And God was, he felt, he was beginning to think that God was unloving and unfair for bringing him all of these afflictions, but he doesn't know that God has taken him to a higher level. See, he really complains. Early in the, and we read, he did not sin, but he wondered, he questioned, he complained, he inquired. And he had every right in the world to do that. And there's not one person here that has not at some time or another done the same thing. Why does this happen? But God is in control. He knows what he's doing. And he's Lord over all. Whatever happens, there must be some reason. Because God is not an irrational, unreasonable God. But he's under no obligation to explain himself to us, and he was under no obligation to explain himself to Job, but he did that and put it in the Bible so that generations of people could learn about the character of God. You see, and that's why it's so necessary that the church understand the Word and the ways of God as far as we're possible, that we look at his Word and not just what we hear and what people tell us and what we think, but God's ways, really, they're past finding out. His ways are higher than ours. Isaiah said this. But still and all, when we ponder and consider the wonders of what he has done. See, Job's friends had judged him on appearances. Remember? Looks like you sinned, Job. And so Job, in the same way, says, looks like you're afflicting me. You know, why? What have I done? But he never admitted that he had sinned because he couldn't think of what he had done that was a sin against God. But Job was judging God on the basis of how things looked to him, and we're all guilty of the same thing. Amen? You know, let God be God. He's sovereign. Well, that does, we start talking about this other big beast. Thank you so much for coming. Appreciate you being here. Nice.